This episode includes the discussion of sensitive topics related to mental health and may be activating for some listeners. We encourage you to take care of yourself. For support and resources, visit beam.community/get help now.
Hey, what's up? I'm YOLO.
I'm Natalie.
And this is Black Healing Remix, the podcast. This is our first episode. So Black Healing Remix, just to give y'all background and context, right? Honestly, several years ago, I was just thinking about all these conversations I was seeing around mental health. Mm-hmm. And I felt like so many of them were so corny, so fake, so surface level. And I was like, this ain't it.
Yeah.
And I was thinking about the conversations I was having with my friends and the conversations I was having in community and the work I was doing. And I was like, we need to remix this shit.
Mm-hmm.
And so from there, I came with this idea of a program called Black Healing Remixed, right? Mm-hmm. Really saying that we're going to talk about Black healing and wellness in a way that really connects to our culture, that isn't about just like diagnostic, cold, frigid, clinical shit, but it's really about honoring the multiplicities of the ways we heal.
Yeah.
The ways in which that shows up in our music, the ways it shows up in, gardening and Reiki and yoga and prayer and all those things, in art, you know what I mean? In style.
Mm-hmm.
And so I wanted to create this program that really represented that and created space for those things to happen. And that really is how Black Healing Remix came to be, you know? And we've done it over the years with, as you know, many people.
Mm-hmm.
Jennifer Lewis.
Yeah, Debbie Allen.
Chloe and Hallie.
Yep, Laura Harrier.
Absolutely. And so the spirit of it is really to take it and be real and authentic. So yeah, we might talk about twerking a little bit as we talk about depression, as we talk about anxiety.
Because all of it's there, right? All of it's a part of how we navigate, how we cope. And the things we love.
Yes. And we don't need these tired mental health conversations that don't really reflect our real full lives.
Right.
That we are still navigating dating, navigating romance, navigating unlearning, and sometimes navigating diagnosis, right?
Mm-hmm.
All these pieces are really happening at the same time. And so I want the remix to have that joy, fun, humor, also the sadness, the frustration, all that mixed in. And that was really my hope when I launched the program, which is now a podcast. And that's what I really want to carry and bring in here into the space as well.
I think it's really important that we talk about BEAM. BEAM stands for the Black Emotional and Mental Health Collective. We really think about a couple of things as really important and central to our work. One being training our community, right? We know that folks are in distress. We know that folks need language to talk about mental health or just time to be together and feel better about whatever we're navigating, right? And so we do trainings across the country. We do grant making, which really is just an opportunity to give folks who are doing really incredible things money to continue that work, right? And I get to lead the whole training and programs department, which is always really fun and exciting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So people often call me the founder and executive director, but I always say that like I was called to initiate this vehicle to create healing for Black folks, right? I'm here to initiate it, and the other people are gonna be a part of making it come into being and holding it into being. You know, for me, real talk, really being honest, I grew up in South Florida, you know, in families and in communities that were struggling with a lot of different things. We were not rich. I grew up seeing family members struggle with substance use, hearing about family members who were living with HIV and AIDS and often in language that was not loving. Seeing a lot of my family members and community folks struggle with things that I now have the language to know are depression,
mm-hmm.
that I now know as anxiety, but back then did not know.
And that really nobody knew, for the most part in our community,
yeah,
right?
Absolutely.
It's like, it was just a way someone was.
Absolutely.
We didn't have the language to know like, oh, this is actually how distress shows up,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, absolutely. And so that was my reality. But I remember as a little person being like, you know, deeply impacted by everything and hurt and frustrated and confused. But, you know, becoming an adult who then got opportunity to have access to resources and tools to go to like to study Black studies and women's studies and social work and psychology and begin to understand, oh, wait, we didn't have resources. This was designed this way. The mental health distress we were experiencing was from generations of distress, like really being able to see that, but also being able to see the beauty of like, oh, we did have healing modalities, though,
mm-hmm.
because sitting on the porch was a contemplative practice.
Mm-hmm.
You know, cooking them greens and certain meals were really nourishing to our spirit and our bodies, right?
Gathering around a Sunday meal.
Absolutely.
Gardening, all these different healing things that we did. The Epsom salt that was on the side of our grandmother's tub.
Tell it.
Right? These are all ways that we coped, we strategized, we recovered. we took a moment to pause. All of those things are part of it. And when we look into the world, we recognize that for Black folks, these are our traditions, right? These are the things folks pass down to us. But we also recognize the discrepancy between what the rest of the world would say, like, oh, here's a medical intervention, right? Mm-hmm. And we recognize that, like, but our folks survived.
Yes, come on.
Horrifying things, right? And so there had to be some tools, there had to be some skills and some brilliance in all of that.
Come on and tell it. And I think that's a big part of my hope and wish for Beam was to, like, not only, like, give us more resources and tools, but celebrate all the tools and resources that we've had, right? To celebrate that, like, when we were forcibly brought to this land, we brought with us rhythm, songs, herbs, different things to help ourselves heal. That we are not new to healing, because therapy and this movement to make Black folks go to therapy is really new in the context of human
history.
Like, we're talking about, like, the last 5 to 7 years, yeah. It's become a prominent conversation. So we had to have some kind of healing strategy, and we had it in the barbershops, in the salons. It wasn't always perfect, because no healing modality is.
Right.
But my hope for Beam was that it would also help us uplift ourselves and our strategies,
yeah.
And see the tools, because sometimes I look at some of these psychological interventions, and I've actually, like, you know, facilitated, like, CDC effective behavioral health interventions, and realize, I'm like, huh, this is things that Black people actually already do already.
Already been there.
Like, the practices that we have.
But we also don't always have the name for it,
yes.
Right?
Yes.
And so we sometimes invalidate the practices that we actually have that are ours because we don't have a name for it. It's just the way we do things.
And I really want to shift to, like, Nally, how you came to Beam. Now, you are the director of training and programs, so Nally's holding down everything, you know, making sure the trainings, the programs, the healing circles all go off without a hitch. But you also are a really powerful, beautiful human being who's had a journey that brought you along to Beam,
yeah.
of your own healing and wellness. And so
yeah.
I'm curious about how it connects. What's that like for you?
Well, you know, I think about that I am a Black, queer, plus-size woman in the world. That represents a lot of things, right? I'm the youngest in my family. And I think I grew up like many people, right? With a single mom who's working very hard, not always having the attention and emotional capacity to fully support me as an individual, but just raising my brother and sister, like, hey, come on, all y'all, right? And I was like, but there's specific things that I need or want, and that wasn't really available, right? And so I think, you know, for me, my first healing intervention was a journal. Right? I started writing as a very young person. I kept a journal and I essentially was just soothing myself, right? Just saying, this is what's up. This is how this is going. I don't like this. Talking back and forth with myself because it didn't feel safe to communicate my inner world with the external world. And so, you know, I think I became a poet out of this trying to understand what was going on, recognizing that my parents split up when I was very, very young and my father just disappeared, essentially. And then there was a day when I was like, where is my dad exactly? Like, what's going on? And, you know, recognizing that folks struggle with substance use and different things, and that's not always appropriate to tell a 4 or 5 year old, right? But I needed something. And so I was looking for creativity, for expression, and poetry became the tool for me. And so I think all the work that I do is a love letter to the world, is a version of a poem. Right? And I don't think everything has to be written. Some of it is experienced in real time, right? That my greatest hope is that someday someone will look back at the person I have been and they will see the through line of what I have written, of the things that I said and what I became, right? When there was no promise that that would be true, but diligence and focus and returning to myself again and again and again and being willing to heal again and again makes being at Beam obvious because this is the work we do every day with our teams, in the world, in our trainings, with a podcast. It's all a part of the practice. And so being here is obvious. It's like duh to me.
I love your honesty and, like, the way you're framing it about talking about, you know, your mother's experience of trying to raise you under very frantic and often, like, distressing conditions, which is the reality of a lot of our parents.
Absolutely.
Right? Think about what my mother was given, which was so little, to give to me.
Yeah.
And I think about, like, oh, how could you have shown up differently? What did you have?
My mom and I talk about that all the time now. And I'm like, I don't know how you raised us. Because, like, honey, I'm trying to figure it out now with no kids, with no, like, right, still trying to figure it out. And you had 3 kids and no partner and a job and with these people that don't like you and all the things. And you still were trying to do it in a way that held us in dignity, that let us know we were beautiful and valuable and wonderful and could be something. and without all the proper support to be able to do that.
When I hear those stories about single parents with the Black fathers or mothers holding that down, you know, like a lot of times we feel that sense of pride and gratitude for them, right? But also feel rage at the system that created the conditions that made so many Black mothers and fathers have to struggle that way.
100%.
You know, the ways in which labor is designed to underpay folks, all those different dimensions that create so much trauma and distress on Black moms and Black fathers. You know, I'm just thinking about that piece.
And I also think about, like, you know, my father, who is this beautiful human who got involved with drugs, right? And not intentionally, he wasn't trying to derail his life, right? It's a moment that happens. And then a lot of other things happen as a result of that, right? And I think about, you know, the pain that he's experienced as a result of losing his family, right? Of in the midst of and in the 80s when, like, what kind of care were you going to get? What were you going to do if people were navigating really challenging things? There was nothing really you could do except try to save yourself, essentially, which is a lot about what my mom and I talk about, of like, she had to make choices to preserve us. And what did that do to my father? What did that do to her? What did that do to me? And there's damage everywhere, but also an immense amount of love and forgiveness and grace for that everybody's doing the best that they can.
Absolutely. Under really horrible and sometimes challenging conditions.
Absolutely.
Right? And I think about some of the first work you did with us was really writing workshops.
Absolutely.
Right? And I'm also thinking about holding that with the legacy of writing and poetry in our country, or with Black folks, like of Nikki Giovanni, Langston Hughes, you know, June Jordan, Audre Lorde, like, you know, County Cullen, these poets who echoed and spoke our experience, mm-hmm. right? As a healing modality.
Absolutely.
Right? And journaling as a healing modality. Could you share a little more about that?
Yeah, I mean, when you think about every monumental moment, we're looking for the words to describe it, to translate it to someone else, to tell them the importance or the significance of this moment. And so for me as an artist, I see myself as a translator in many ways, as I'm taking the emotional experience I'm feeling and trying to put this inexplicable thing into words such that a stranger with a sentence can understand exactly what it felt like, right? And I think that's so important for us in a time where feelings are complicated.
Yeah.
I think poetry is a magnificent tool for, like, self-healing, but also self-actualization. I think about the things that I wrote about that I'm now living, right? As a result of being diligent to come back to, like, this is who I say I am. These are the things that I want. And then continuing to walk in that path line of what I have written for myself. And I think there's a beautiful synchronicity in that.
I love that. And I think even if we want to take it to that Western academic approach, you know, there's all this literature and evidence that shows that these practices actually have been proven to alleviate anxiety, mm-hmm. right? That journaling daily actually is a practice that can help connection to self and self-reflexivity, right?
Yep.
And so once again, strategies that Black folks been doing, poetry, writing as practices, and then like you bringing that to Beam through your own journey
mm-hmm.
With wellness is really beautiful and powerful.
I'm curious about what it's felt like for you to start with this idea and it be this thing that employs many people and supports their families and does really beautiful work in the world that is transformative, that also is statistically significant. So what does that feel like for you?
I am still in shock and in awe and in gratitude that I feel like a huge responsibility. I feel very called.
Hmm.
I feel like ancestors were like, we are charging you to do this. And so I don't take that lightly.
Hmm.
You know, I think that like in many ways, what is it? Toni Morrison says you write the books that you want to read.
Mm-hmm.
I think I'm consistently trying to create the institution and the programs that I needed, that I think my family needed, that I think my community needed, right? I'm thinking about Black Masculinity Reimagined, which is our community building program, working with men, Black men and masculine folks to unlearn the rigidity that we've learned around masculinity, to learn healthier, more expansive ways of expressing love and intimacy and connection and rage and frustration, to support mental health. If my community would have had that, what would have been possible?
Absolutely.
You know, I think about like the Black Parent Support Fund, where we give economic funds directly to Black parents living with mental conditions or supporting with children living with mental conditions.
You very often will ask us like, so what do you want to do to like encourage us to push the envelope, right? In a world that says, well, why would you be giving Black people money?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Right? Which is what people have said to us about these different kinds of funds that we've set up, is they say, well, why is that important or why is that significant? And we go, because we know what our mamas needed.
Yeah.
we know what our cousins needed.
Come on now.
Which was money, not just someone telling, like, right? We needed some dollars to get some groceries. We needed certain very specific things to move us forward. And sometimes the difference between liberation in the moment or feeling devastated is dollars.
Absolutely. Because how can I heal if I don't have groceries and I don't have food?
Right.
How am I healing if I don't have lights? How do I heal in an environment where I'm not sustained and nourished? Like, economic anxiety is real.
Yeah.
When we think about what poverty creates in our bodies, the stress of, like, everyday worrying about money, survival, and will I eat today? And as somebody, I've lived that. Like, you know, like, I remember working at, like, nonprofits in Atlanta where they were pimping the language of liberation and barely paying me a living wage, and I'm eating chickpeas out of a can trying to make checks connect. Right?
Yeah.
Like, I know what that's like. It's so important as we build an institution that is, like, trying to reflect healing, that we uphold that, like, economic justice is healing justice, as one of our partners, Free From, talks about all the time, that we need to have resources and money to sustain ourselves.
Absolutely.
You know? Yeah. In every Beam session, we talk about the feelings wheel. The feelings wheel is just a wheel that shows you all the different ways you can name emotions, right? For me, that was huge when I first saw it. It was a tool to kind of help me, like, name language of feelings, but also make a distinction when I'm talking about feelings and when I'm not.
Mm.
Right? Because I think in our culture, we think we're talking about emotions and we're actually not talking about emotions.
Yes. Like, when we be like, well, you know, somebody says, how are you? And we be like, oh, my tire flat and, you know, the bill and this is that. And it's like, we done told a whole story and we ain't yet said a feeling.
Yep.
Right?
Yep. All the times in which we'll be like, oh, how do you feel about what happened? Well, I just feel like Natalie got a da-da-da. And it's like, wait a second, that's not a feeling, that's a story.
Right.
Because a feeling is one word. A feeling is I'm sad, scared, frustrated, angry. And what was really huge for me in that moment, making that distinction, is that sometimes I was confusing my stories for feelings.
Mm.
And saying, like, oh, my feelings are valid. I'm like, that's not a feeling. That's a whole story you made up about what you think Natalie did.
And now you're trying to defend the story that got holes in it, which why we might have to fight. right? Because, like, obviously, no, but we know that this is what happens, right, in the world, is that we feel like we have to defend our story because our story is attached to our personhood now because I said it. So if you don't believe what I said, now we in opposition. And it's like, well, where is the peace? Where is the progress? Where is the healing? Because there's none. There's no possibility of that there.
And I think that's an important piece, why it's so important to say, like, I have a right to be angry about something someone did to me, even if the story I have around it may be missing holes and pieces, I still have a right to be mad. And there's a difference between saying I have my feeling and my story.
Yeah. But I think also very often why we run from that is that there's a tension, right, with someone sharing how they feel. We are conditioned as a people to do something with what we know.
Mm.
Right?
To fix it.
We got to do something. Oh, you feel sad? Okay, well, let's go do this.
Yeah.
Oh, you upset? Well, let's go do this. Oh, you got broken up with? Okay, well, let's hit the streets. We got to keep it moving.
Yeah,
right?
That's so
because
true.
If we stop, there might be more
yep.
that now we have to unpack.
But because we don't stop to feel, to process. You know, I think talking about my grandmother says all the time, what you repress will return.
Mm.
Right? What you bury in the backyard shows up on the front porch one day. Think about that all the time.
And it's always the worst day.
Right, right.
It's never like the day you're like, yes, I'm ready for this inconvenient ass feeling to show up. It's like the day that you're like, okay, I'm ready to go in the world. And then it's like, here's this thing. And you're like, oh my God, what do I do with this?
And so I think that because like, you know, we talked about this before, like, you know, because we're always moving and pushing past our feelings, all of that's accumulating. It's accumulating in our bodies. Talk about somatic healing. And like, as a yoga teacher, the ways in which, you know, Black folks, there's some literature that shows that Black people have a higher degree of what they call somaticization, right?
Mm.
And somaticization meaning, you know, I have this feeling that these feelings are being held in my body and showing up as different ailments that are medically not connected to anything,
mm-hmm.
right? You go to the doctor and you say your leg hurt, but ain't nothing wrong with your leg medically. Oh, it's actually what happened that day with my cousin.
Mm-hmm.
That I haven't gotten over, but the body remembers,
mm-hmm.
right? All the ways we're holding those things.
And we think about, like, when you're anxious about something and your stomach hurts.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
Or when I'm really excited, my teeth ache.
Yeah.
Right? That we have all these things. When I'm really stressed out, my shoulders are so, so, so tight. Right? All of these things are, like, the somatic embodiment of the emotional experiences that we're holding that very often we just dismiss,
yeah.
right? We just go, oh, okay, well, anyway, let me go get a massage. We're trying to fix it instead of addressing what's the actual thing.
Yep. You know, the piece I always, that's really big for me is that, you know, I think that, like, particularly, like, as a person who's perceived to be a masculine person or whatever, people are always telling you, like, control your feelings, right? You gotta learn how to control your feelings. And it was really powerful for me, like, as a part of my learning and education and therapy and stuff, to learn to, like, oh, you cannot control your feelings. That's a myth. You can manage your behavior in relationship to your feelings, but I can't control what is activated or awakened within me as I'm moving through the world.
Because also, that's the human experience.
Right, exactly.
If you could control that, that would be machinery.
Right.
Right?
What I can manage is how I behave in relationship to what is awakened within me. Mm. How do I say, I can be angry, but also choose not to throw a cup across the room, right? Yeah. Like, you know what I mean? Like, what does that look like? And I think that's really powerful because sometimes, like, we're shamed for having feelings. You know, I often talk about, like, you know, as Black folks, we're often, like, with our heads kind of low, but trying to pretend like we don't have emotions.
Well, I think about that just Black folks in corporate space, right? Yeah. We're not allowed to have an emotional experience. We wait to get to the car and go off with our friend. Oh, these folks got me messed up. They doing whoop-de-woo, right? But in that workplace, we're like, yep, that's fine, even though you just totally stole my idea and minimized my opinion and talked over me again and suck it up and keep moving because I need this job to pay for my stuff and what. And so I'm not about to let you derail all these other things that I got going on. But every time we're swallowing,
yep,
now we're burying.
Yep.
And now we got a lot to dig up.
And it's so profound, too, because, like, you know, my early counseling experience, like I've shared before, is was really working with, like, men. And I think it's important to say I was, like, 27 years old counseling, quote, unquote, like 60, 50-year-old men who were looking at me like, bro, who is this 12-year-old here talking mad smack? Like, you got a lot to say, bro. You ain't lived life, right? But one thing I really recognize and I see now as 42 is that when you've been taught as a child all your life that you can't connect to your feelings, you become an adult who doesn't know how to connect to your feelings.
Mm-hmm. And that doesn't mean that your feelings aren't there.
Right.
That just means you don't know how to connect with them.
Right. You know, and I see the ways in which that in our community has led to so many folks, men, women, other folks, like, feeling isolated and lonely because mm-hmm. you don't feel comfortable sharing or you can't connect to share or are feeling like, you know, suffering from depression and other things because there's all this that you don't want to. I hear people say all the time, like, I'm scared to turn the faucet on because if the faucet come on, I can't turn it off. I hear it all the time. I'm always like, baby, just drip it. Just let it drip.
Yeah.
And cut it back off. You ain't got to, like, go, oh, Lord, you, like, slow.
Yeah.
But, like, I think that, like, so many of us and so many of our folks are struggling because we received that message very early on that we can't have feelings. Mm. And now everybody's trying to play the game of pretending they don't have feelings and suffering because of it. You know, this is Black Healing Remix. We want to bring in all the nuances. We have to talk explicitly about, like, why a lot of Black folks don't go to therapy and other tools and get other access to tools to process feelings, right? You know, one of the things that was so important to me to really hold when I was building Beam was to hold that Black folks continue to be and have been historically demonized, denigrated, abused, and harmed and violated and sometimes killed by the mental health industrial complex, which often looks like the prison industrial complex.
It oftentimes is the prison right. industrial complex now. Yeah.
Like I often talk about that, like, you know, most people's first experience with a therapist is actually not the Black woman with the great, big, well-lit, office. Yeah. It's actually somebody who's overrun, who don't really care about what you got going, who got a whole bunch of file notes they got to do. Because I've been that case manager who has been in that situation, right? And so really, like, understanding that our fear of engaging psychiatry of therapy is legitimately based in real trauma that is ongoing. I can tell you how many times I've been in community and someone's like, when I hear mental health, I think about my cousin who was taken away after he had an episode and now he's in prison. And he's been in prison forever.
Right.
And if we don't understand and hold that is the reality, that, like, there's carceral systems that are not invested in care, but they're just invested in making money off of Black bodies inside of these institutions.
Mm-hmm.
If we don't hold that and challenge these systems to actually be about healing, we're missing the remix.
Absolutely.
You know, the remix has to be about how do we create care systems that really are about care for our folks and not about, you know, trying to make you a productive citizen or make you fix you or over-medicating you, right? What does that look like? And how do we also do that? We're also holding that medicine is needed sometimes.
Absolutely.
You know?
And can be extremely helpful for folks.
Right.
Right? It's all the pieces.
Yes.
And I think that's what we do best is talk about the nuance, the detail, and kind of unearth and provide space to process that gently and lovingly, knowing that, like, just because we talk about a hard thing doesn't mean we have to, like, fall completely apart, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah,
that
yeah.
We can talk about it to the degree that we can. And yes. So majority of our practices, all of them really, are consent-based, yeah. Right? That we will extend invitations and try things on.
Mm-hmm.
And some days I'd be like, ooh, I ain't with a sacred pause. I don't want to take no breaths, right? And some days I'm like, child, I need a breath. I need a breath. Yeah, yeah, give me a breath, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And recognizing that as we evolve and grow, so do the things we need to support us.
Yeah.
And that's my greatest hope for all of us, right? Is that we find the right combination of things for us so that thriving becomes a real thing for us, not just an aspirational goal.
Ashe. Last piece I want to say is we're talking about this concept of healing justice, which is really important to me, right? It's not enough to just do healing work. It has to be within the context of understanding how misogyny and transphobia and homophobia and anti-blackness really create mental health distress.
Absolutely.
Right? The ways in which we teach and communicate to trans folks that they're less than cisgender people.
Mm-hmm.
When you have been taught all your life that your life is not valuable, that you are something to be ridiculed, killed, violated without consequence, that has a consequence on your mental health.
Absolutely.
When as a queer child being taught every single day of my life that, like, you know, being gay as a quote unquote man is one of the most disgusting things you can be, that has an impact on your mental health. And so many Black gay men and Black gay women are struggling with that now.
Mm-hmm.
Struggling with being kicked out of home because they were taught by some religious institution that their child is not worthy of love because of who they are attracted to.
Mm-hmm.
And so understand that healing justice says we can't just be like, oh, it dismissed that. We have to understand that there are systems and ideas that have communicated that certain people's lives are not valuable. And we have to dismantle those concepts to hold the immanence and worthiness of all human beings and create a society that centers healing and support for all people, not just the white, cisgender, heterosexual people, not just the Black straight man, not just the Black straight woman, but all of us.
And the realization that that's hard, that it's messy,
mm-hmm.
that it's imperfect, and will require diligence and healing practices and so much communication. And that's part of why I love healing justice, is because it says we're doing all the things right now, all the time, right? Which is very Scorpio, right? We want to do all the stuff, right? And also learning how to pace ourselves, learning how to have grace for ourselves, hold ourselves in dignity, hold each other in dignity. It's a tall order.
It's a tall order. It's hard too, because, like, the biggest part of my early work I remember is that trying to be kind to each other in the midst of our unlearning. Like, Audre Lorde has this quote, which I'm probably going to mess up, but she says, when disagreeing with each other, we were often more vile with each other than the actual people who are the root cause of our problems.
Mm.
She talked about the ways in which Black movements and spaces where we were arguing and being nastier to each other as Black folks than to the white folks who actually built the institutions that are creating the problems for us.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how internalized anti-Blackness works, right? You're shaming people for being poor, not realizing that systems actually were designed to make them poor.
And also, right? Not, like, having, I mean, the awareness, right, of the context of humans, systems, all the layers,
yes.
Right? We're just seeing this person, yep. Doing this thing and going, well, why you don't get it together?
Right.
And I go, what's going on around them,
yes.
That has them in this predicament?
Yes.
Do they have water?
Yeah.
Have they had a meal today?
Yes.
Right? Let's talk about all the things, not just the thing you're seeing in this moment.
Absolutely. I think about Dr. Bruce Perry, who has a book with Oprah called What Happened to You, right?
Mm.
And the whole premise of the book is really understanding that everybody we see, when we have the auntie who's really irritable, who's always in a bad mood, as opposed to being like, well, she just like that, or that she just nasty, thinking about what happened to auntie? What did auntie experience that that's her state? What did she go through as a 60, 70-year-old Black woman? Every single, what support needs to be present,
mm-hmm.
You know? Instead of thinking like, oh, just like laughing or diminishing people, thinking when we see someone who's struggling with what we now know is depression, or we call depression, thinking about what have they been through? What generationally have they been through?
Or even not when people have a diagnosis, but
right.
Just when we see people struggling.
Absolutely.
Do we lean in with empathy or do we just judge them?
Yeah.
Which is like, I mean, part of, you know, social media, I think, is like you see tons of posts and you look in the comments. where is the empathy for that these are real people going through things? And you know, there's certainly a lot to unpack there.
Yeah.
But I think about just how cruel we are to each other.
Yeah.
Just as if it's okay.
But the meanness is also symptomatic of depression.
Absolutely.
I think people don't realize that. Like, sometimes when I, like, you know, a lot of times in the gay community, they'd be like, oh, the black gay girl, the mean girls. I'm like, yeah, that's depression for a lot of them. It's grief. It's sadness. It's isolation. We haven't been, like, you know, I think about Dr. Tima. Right here, who talks about, like, you know, how irritability and meanness comes out of despair, right? And how it makes sense that many of us are in despair as black folks in this country, given the conditions we are living under.
Absolutely.
So when we see that understanding that someone is navigating something that we don't understand or is difficult, and having compassion and grace for them and asking for the same for ourselves, giving ourselves the same grace, right? Because you know, I think about the ways in which Western world teaches us is, it's the Jerry Springer effect, I call it, where it's like, at least I'm not you. And so we feel, we try to build this erroneous, this false sense of self-esteem on this idea that at least I'm not that person, and therefore I'm good, quote unquote. And that's not dignity.
Right.
That's not integrity. Like, it's built inherently on shame, as opposed to understanding that, like, you know, who we are is inherently worthy, regardless of what condition or situation we're in. It is the systems that try to communicate that we are not worthy, and they're liars.
Mm-hmm. And what can we do, right? Which is resource ourselves, Go into our own story, figure out what's actually happening for us. And I think a lot of times we just point outward instead of going, what's happening here?
Yep.
What's going on with me that got me acting this way out in the world?
Yeah, it's the same thing I used to say about, like, transphobic violence. Like, you know, of course, the folks are people who are watching, like, you know, black trans folks are experiencing disproportionate violence, particularly black trans women. And I always think about when I see these videos of these horrible incidents, you have these women who often are minding their business in public spaces.
Literally minding their business.
And then this brother, who's often, it's often a black man, unfortunately, sometimes it's been men of other color, but, like, often it's been black men, sees this woman, this black trans woman, living her life. And whatever is awakened within you, instead of going within and saying, why when I see this woman, am I so frustrated and angry?
Am I so mad that I am called to violence? What's happening?
What's happening within me? The response is, let me destroy you so I don't have to feel that discomfort. Let me harm you. And what that comes from in many places is that gender is often socialized through violence.
Yeah.
That men learn this is the way to be a man by being slapped when your wrist is limp. By being cursed out or beat up when you're playing with the Barbie dolls and the My Little Ponies. So when you see somebody living outside of that construct, however you perceive it, someone that you might think is a certain gender, we're all trained to be the police of gender.
Yeah.
We got a pink shirt on. Why she being strong? And we devastate our mental health every day because we erode each other by policing these gendered concepts, as opposed to being like, you got a pink shirt on. Good for him, bro.
Also, why do we care?
But it's about, that's how shame works.
Yeah.
It makes us feel like it's conformity. You got to conform to the vision, my vision of the world, for me to feel comfortable. Because I need the psychological comfort of everything being like me. And when it's not like me, I need to denigrate it, destroy it, or dismiss it.
The educator in me is always like, what's one thing that we can, like, identify in ourselves where we have to minimize somebody else to feel big? Because we all do it in some way.
Yeah, yeah, it's true.
Where is it showing up in our lives, in our actions? Maybe it's the small voice in our head where we talk to ourselves in a horrible way.
So, woo! This is just giving y'all a little taste, y'all, a little tease of what we be doing, how we gonna be talking, what's gonna come up in the conversation. But we really wanna invite you to this reflexive journey with us, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
And so as you listen to this episode, hopefully you had some little things, gems maybe popped up in your head. Maybe you're thinking about how you are showing up in the world. We want to invite you to consider that, to be reflexive.
Yeah, maybe you spend 5 minutes journaling tonight.
Yeah, yeah. And write the first thing that comes to your mind. Just let it all out. And honor that you are worthy of the practice, that it is valuable to invest in yourself.
And that practice don't mean perfect.
Yeah.
We ain't gotta nail it every time. Let's dispel the myth that we have to be perfect. Let's be a practicing people, that we are getting closer to who we want to be through practice and discipline, as opposed to needing to be perfect every single time.
Yes. And let's practice being more loving.
Mm.
Let's practice being more compassionate, being better listeners, showing up for ourselves and each other with boundaries, with the generosity to the extent that we can. Let's practice, and let's just reimagine. Like, know that, like, your wildest dream for what Black communities can look like could be possible. Your wildest dream for what life can look like for Black folks who might be living with mental conditions and those who don't can be possible for that care, for that joy.
Absolutely.
We can do it. We are doing it now. And so I'm charging you as a watcher, as a listener right now, to reimagine your boldest, most luscious, most juiciest dream for love for our folks and go out and make the steps to make that possible.
Even just one teeny tiny first step.
Ashe.
Right? Because that's where it begins. We're so grateful to be in this conversation, to be in this moment where we get to interrogate, look at, think about the nuance of how mental health is showing up.
Ashe. So we're going to close with a little affirmation practice. Sometimes, like when we do an episode, we want to, you know, just think about what's something we want to affirm after this conversation. What's something we want to hold for ourselves? And maybe you are thinking about what you want to affirm for yourself. Maybe something got activated within you. Now, I want to turn it to you. What's an affirmation that this conversation has brought to you that you want to hold?
I'm sitting with that I am willing to grow even when it's uncomfortable. Because, honey, we could grow when it's comfortable. But that ain't, I don't know if that's really growth. But I know that when we grow through something that really churns up something in us, there is so much beauty on the other side of that. And I'm here for that. I'm here for that.
I love that. Mine is, I will lean into the discomfort and let it lead me to love. I'm going to lean into the discomfort of those conversations with family members, partners that make me feel icky and yucky and just be in the yuckiness and know that sometimes on the other side of that yuckiness and ickiness is the breakthrough, it's the growth, it's the love.
Because that's the practice.
That's the practice.
It's the practice.
I'm not going to run away from it. I'm going to lean into it.
Okay.
And lead me to love. Maybe Michael B. Jordan.
Lord.
Thank y'all so much for joining us on Black Healing Remix, the podcast.
The podcast.
We will see you next time.